This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
Okay, today we are going to talk about Pesach, and we're going to start, we're going to do it from a broad angle and then a very narrow angle. So let's start with a broad angle. We know that there are three holidays. We know the Torah talks about three holidays, and they're called the Shalosh Regalim. These three holidays are called the Shalosh Regalim, literally three foot festivals, because every one of the holidays, all the Jews had to walk to Jerusalem before the holiday to get to Yerushalayim, get to the temple and stay in the temple for the holiday, and bring korbanot, bring sacrifices and other things, and celebrate their holidays in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, Bezrat Hashem. And we will do this again. So now, it's interesting because the three stages and these holidays are viewed in, the Torah describes in two different terms. One of the terms it uses is this idea of the holidays, the seasons and the agricultural cycle. It's interesting that the holidays are linked to the seasons. For example, Pesach is Chodesh Aviv. We delay Pesach. We delay the Pesach to the spring. That's why this year we had two Adars. We had Adar Aleph and Adar Bet to push the Pesach into the spring. Why? Because our lunar calendar is 254 days and the solar calendar is 265 days. We're 11 days short in the lunar calendar. So the Jewish law, we make up for that 11 days to have a leap month. Every 2-3 years, we have a leap month, which is called Adar Bet, the second Adar. And why? Because Pesach has to fall into the spring. Pesach has to fall into spring. We know the spring is this planting season. Pesach is associated with the spring. Pesach has to be in the spring, has to be in the planting season. Shavuot is called Chodesh Hagat Katzir, which is the festival of reaping, which is reaping the produce, reaping the grain that grows. The barley and the wheat has to grow, and the festival of reaping. And Sukkot is known as the festival of Hag HaSif, which is the gathering of fruits. So it's the fruit festival. So the festivals are termed in number one way of describing it is in terms of the seasons and agriculture. The second way of delineating the festivals is it's a kind of freedom, Torah, Israel. It's all about history. So Pesach is the holiday of our freedom. Shavuot is the holiday of our Torah. And Sukkot is the lulav and the etrog, these palm fronds and the etrogim. They delineate Eretz Yisrael. They discuss Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because where else will you find these beautiful, luscious fruits and plants only in a country which is blessed with rain and has all these varieties. So Sukkot represents Israel. So three things. Pesach represents freedom. Hashem took us out of Egypt. Lakachti etchem la'am. I took you as my people. Shavuot represents giving of the Torah. And Sukkot represents Eretz Israel. So three things. So there's two different ways the Torah describes the three festivals. Number one is an agricultural context. Number two is the historical context. So agricultural context, which is a festival of spring, festival of our reaping, and festival of our gathering of the fruits. Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. The second context is the historical context. The Pesach is the holiday of our freedom. Shavuot is the holiday of the giving of the Torah. And Sukkot is the holiday where we talk about Eretz Israel, because that's the all the fruits and the vegetables that we use on Sukkot, referring to Eretz Israel. So three stages, the agricultural stage, and then you have historical stage. There's another stage, which is mentioned by the Sfat Emet. The Sfat Emet is interesting commentary on the Torah, Sfat Emet. He talks about the marriage between God and Israel, this metaphorical marriage between God and Israel. Obviously, it's a metaphor. Talking about our lives together, God and his people, and it's a metaphor for marriage between us and God, which is symbolized in the Shir HaShirim, in Kabbalistic works. This is a very Kabbalistic idea of marrying ourselves to God. On Shavuot, we're going to talk about the different stages. So he talks about the three stages of marriage. The first stage is the Erusin. Erusin is the betrothal. It's the betrothal before the wedding. The betrothal, in those days, there was two separate ceremonies. Today, we do them all together at the wedding ceremony. We have the betrothal, which is the ring, the giving of the ring. A person puts a ring on his wife's finger, And he says, "Hurry up, Mekudeshet li mitabat zu, kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, you are sanctified to me with this ring, according to the laws of Moses and Israel." And that is the betrothal. That is called Kiddushin. That is the betrothal. And that is symbolized by Pesach. Pesach is the betrothal. And the second part of marriage is, now it's interesting, after the first part of marriage, they cannot live together as man and wife. The betrothal allows them, they're technically married, but they're not allowed to live together. They're married, but not allowed to live together. And that's why today we don't do it separately. We don't want to get anyone into trouble, cause any problems. And therefore we do today the betrothal and the marriage at the same time. So what is the marriage? The second part of the ceremony is called Nisuin. Nisuin is the marriage ceremony. And that is basically the chuppah. The chuppah, the canopy over the heads. The Sephardic custom is you put the talit, the groom's talit, to symbolize his tent over there, both their heads to symbolize his bride is coming into his tent. Otherwise, you just use the chuppah, which is the marriage canopy over their heads. And that is the second stage of marriage. The second stage of marriage is the chuppah. And that is symbolized by Shavuot. Shavuot. And that is a beautiful saying. That's when we read the ketubah. So the ketubah is the giving of the Torah. The giving of the Torah symbolizes the ketubah. And the ketubah, it's interesting because the old Ladino minhag was to read a ketubah on Shavuot. It took ages. It took a ketubah on Shavuot. And they opened the ark to take out the Torah. They read the ketubah in Ladino. So it's like a metaphorical ketubah written by Rabbi Yehuda Levi, which delineates the obligations, which is the ketubah's obligations, the man to his wife and the wife to the husband. And that was a beautiful ceremony of reading the ketubah on Shavuot. It's a ketubah ceremony in Shavuot. And he talks about, this is the Sfat Emet, is the third stage. And the third stage is of the Nisuin, is the chuppah. And that's the Sukkot. Sukkot is going to the Sukkah. So let's recap. So Pesach is the betrothal. He gives the ring. Okay, so the Torah says the word for betrothal in the Torah is ki kach ishisha. When a man takes a wife, and taking a wife is symbolic of the betrothal. And Hashem took us out of his tribe. He says, "I'm taking you for my people." And that is the betrothal. That is the ring ceremony, Pesach, ring ceremony. Shavuot is reading the ketubah, which is symbolized by the giving of the Torah. The Torah is our ketubah. And that's the second part of the wedding ceremony. And the Sukkot is the actual chuppah itself, which is the sukkah. The sukkah is the chuppah, the wedding canopy. A person goes into the sukkah, they got to remember, it's the wedding canopy, that this is our marriage to Hashem. Okay, so then now we are man and wife. And that's why the happiest day of the year is Shmini Atzeret, which is straight after Sukkot. It's like the Shavuot Brachot, all in one day. Simchat Torah, the simcha of being married to Hashem, Baruch Hashem. So let's go through that again, just repeat it once more. So Pesach is the engagement. We give the ring. Hashem gave us the ring. He took us out of Egypt. He took us as his wife, took us out of Egypt. That's the betrothal. Number two is Shavuot. Shavuot is the reading of the ketubah. The ketubah is the Torah. Hashem's contract, marriage contract between us and God is the ketubah, is the Torah. The Torah tells us our obligations towards God, and Hashem gives us his obligation towards us. And the third part of the ceremony is the sukkot, is the chuppah. The chuppah is the sukkah. We go into the sukkah, that's the chuppah. And that's the third different way of describing the three festivals. So the first way is in terms of seasons and agriculture, Chodesh Aviv, it's the holiday of the spring, of planting, and Chag HaKatzir, Shavuot is Chag HaKatzir, it's the holiday of the harvest, and Sukkot is Chag HaSif, for gathering the fruits. And the second way is the historical context of Pesach. Hashem took us out of Egypt, and we got the Torah, and then we're going to Eretz Israel. And then we have the marriage concept. That Pesach is the time of the giving of the betrothal, giving the ring. Hashem took us out of Egypt. He made a contract with us, but it's a betrothal contract. And then on Shavuot, we have the ketubah, which is the giving of the Torah. And that's the marriage contract written down and the obligations of man to his wife. And then we have the third part of the ceremony, which is the chuppah, which is the sukkah. So there's three different ways of describing these three festivals, three different ways of the symbolism of these festivals. And finally, the last day of Sukkot, as we mentioned, Shmini Atzeret, is the modest meal that the bride and groom partake of together in the occasion of the Yichud, or the actual wedding meal. So that is also a part of the marriage celebration. So Shmini Atzeret Simchat Torah is part of the marriage celebration. And this is the interpretation of the Sfat Emet. What is the seventh day of Pesach? Now, this is interesting. The seventh day of Pesach, we have a festival, the seventh day, the first day of Pesach in Israel, the last day of Pesach outside Israel, 2 days of Pesach at the beginning and 2 days at the end. The seventh day of Pesach is when we cross the sea. The seventh day of Pesach is when we cross the sea. What does that signify? And the answer is very important. Very, very important. The Gemara says, it's hard. Marriage is hard like crossing the sea. Two things are hard like crossing the sea. One of them is marriage. And number two is making a living. Two things are compared to crossing the sea. Now, this is very interesting. So the seventh day of Pesach, what does it signify? So I believe if we are to pursue marriage metaphor, it represents not another stage, rather a new bundle of insights into marriage. The seventh day of Pesach is that day when the Red Sea split or the Reed Sea split. It's the day of Kriyat Yam Suf. And the rabbis use this event of Kriyat Yam Suf in their own marriage metaphor, when they said, Kasheh Zvugo Shel Adam Ki Kriyat Yam Suf. The marriage of a person is often as difficult as the splitting of the Red Sea. What does this indicate? So let's just give three insights into this idea. Why is the marriage of a person hard like crossing the sea? And this is a really interesting idea. The first of which is risk. Taking. There's no such thing before you get married to know for sure this marriage is going to work. Every marriage is taking a risk. Every time a person gets married, hopefully it's just once, they're taking a risk. You have to realize that. When a person gets married, they're taking a risk. I mean, that's the reason why many people don't want to get married. They don't want to take the risk. They don't want to have a breakdown of the marriage later on. They don't take a risk. They're risking it. It's financial risk. It's a family risk. It's all kinds of risks. And therefore, the crossing of the sea is symbolic of marriage. When he jumped, Nachshon ben Aminadab jumped into the sea before it split, he took a tremendous risk. And that is what the rabbis are trying to tell us. Number one is getting married is taking a risk. But it's a worthwhile risk. You have to have faith in God and get married. You have to have faith in God that things will work out. You have to try your best for it to work out. So that's number one. Is that marriage is like crossing the sea, it's risk-taking. And very few things in life are certain. At best, we can have only a dim and vague perception of things to come. Marriage certainly seems to be one of the most uncertain ventures, especially today. To enter into marriage is an act of faith and of awareness of all the risks attendant upon this decision. And one who gets married without thinking about the risks is getting married blindly. And that's pretty dangerous, okay? So intelligent marriage is an act of faith in a state of high consciousness, alertness, and awareness of this unknown, and yet a willingness to commit oneself because of a higher and deeper feeling, because of an intuition that is worth the plunge into the sea of problems and pleasures, of dangers and delights, and hopefully the sea will split. The second is an interesting idea, is the Red Sea, crossing into the sea, jumping into the sea, following the marriage metaphor of religious life as well, a marriage to God, crossing into the sea. Commitment to religion is an act of faith. Commitment to religion is an act of faith. We live in a tempestuous and convulsive age. Listen, we're going through this right now, another convulsion, another tempest, which we are beset by all kinds of demands, all kinds of pulls, all kinds of pressures, all kinds of tensions. Pure, absolute, and consistent faith is extremely difficult to come by. At best, our faith grows and our faith gets less. But if a person is going to wait until all 100% sure of every aspect of Judaism, until he understands everything and has no doubts left, he will spend their life in limbo and never achieve the greatness of faith. Religious commitment is, after all, fundamentally an act of faith, and the willingness to embrace all the risks that commitment entails. Perhaps this is why the contemporary writers talk about the leap of faith. Leaping of faith, it's really a leap into the sea. The sea symbolizes our relationship with God, the marriage to God. Jump into the marriage to God. Have a leap of faith, and you'll see the sea will split. Bezrat Hashem, we'll all get this higher awareness of Hashem, higher awareness of faith, and the sea will split. The religious sea will split. And the third insight is the true miracle of the Red Sea was not so much the parting of the waters, right? Because the Torah describes it as the east wind blew all night and blew the water. The main miracle was that the waters stayed split and the water turned into something dry, turned into walls. The water stood on both sides like walls, and the bottom of the sea was dry. It was they could walk on it. And that was the miracle. The miracle was there was a wall to the right, a wall to the left, until the children of Israel passed through it. The greatness of the Red Sea was not in creating the phenomena, but in sustaining the phenomena. That's a very important lesson for marriage, both our marriage to God and marriage to our spouse. And that is that it's not enough to get married. Any fool can get married. It's staying married. That is the miracle. Staying married with the fact that the sea split. Okay, the sea split, the wind blew, but it stayed split. And that's the key to marriage. A successful marriage is staying married. It's easy to get married. Any fool can get married. It's hard to stay married. Weddings, despite all the complexity of the arrangements, are simple and trivial with compared to the intricacies of and the wisdom required for the much longer and more faithful duration of the marriage. Real wisdom consists in preserving marriage, enhancing it, and enriching it. To enjoy marriage, to feel that companionship, which is so important for a human being, to have companionship and not to be lonely, to build on the companionship. And it's not just emotional, but it's psychological. A person needs someone to talk to. A friend in need is a friend indeed. So build a relationship of friendship in a marriage. So real wisdom consists in preserving a marriage, enhancing a marriage, enriching a marriage. And this is true as well in our relationship with Hashem. We live in a truly crazy age. We're beset by the currents, every fad, every fashion, every new thing. And then all the tests of faith we have in Israel, outside Israel. Some Jews opt into the Jewish community and into Jewish faith. Some Jews opt out of the community, out of Jewish faith. So it's like an escalator is going up, an escalator is going down, which is really symbolic of the Seder. The escalator is going up. The Rasha becomes the evil person, becomes an Ena, he becomes a Tam, simpleton, he becomes a She'eni Odeh L'Shah, he doesn't know how to ask questions, and eventually he'll become a Chacham. There's an escalator going up, but there's also an escalator going down. The Chacham can have questions which he can't answer, become a Rasha, and then he loses his knowledge, becomes a She'eni Odeh L'Shah, and becomes a Tam, he doesn't know anything. So there's two escalators on Pesach, and this is symbolized by the crossing of the sea. That the crossing of the sea is standing and making sure those walls are solid. Then you have that leap of faith and staying with that faith, making the marriage strong between us and our spouses and make the marriage between us and God strong. And that is the miracle. The miracle is that the walls of the sea stood. It wasn't just the crossing of the sea and the splitting of the sea. So we have to learn that momentary inspiration and heroic urges alone are not enough. Jewish life on the highest level, and this holds true also for those who are born religious, is that it requires constant care, ceaseless attention. No one can ever be sure one's children, of one's spouse, of oneself. One must never be overconfident. One must always labor and nourish this delicate and precious flower of faith. The third thing we can learn from the sea, the splitting of the sea, is happiness. Happiness, the splitting of the sea tells us about happiness because the seventh day of Pesach, when the sea split, is one in which we read the reaction of Bnei Yisrael. What was the reaction of Bnei Yisrael? The Bnei Yisrael reacted with Shira, with a song. The song of the sea, which we say every single day in our prayers, in Shacharit, the song of Sri Az Yashim Moshe of Bnei Yisrael. We react with tremendous singing, with tremendous joy, with tremendous happiness. Believe me, we can imagine, you know, the Jews, yeah, they're running away from Egypt, the travails, the 3 days, 7 days in the desert, they're running away from Egypt. They see the clouds behind them of dust of the Egyptian army, their horses, the cavalry, the people, the infantry marching towards them. They're terrified. They jump into the sea. The sea splits. They're walking through the sea. The Egyptians are dying in the sea. And what do Bnei Israel do? What is their reaction? Shira. Joy. They reach the highest pinnacles of revelation and joy. Consider what they had gone through. How many of us in that situation would have sung songs? How many of their family and compatriots have been lost during the 10 plagues? How frightened they were, how overwhelmed they still must have been by the terrible tragedies which confronted them and which they so narrowly averted. It was a time perhaps to breathe a sigh of relief, but hardly one in which to sing. Yet that is precisely what they did. Perhaps that is why, when the rabbi said the marriage of a person is difficult in the splitting of the sea, that marriage, despite its problems and tensions, its difficulties and its demands, must be characterized by shira, with song and joy. Sometimes people are fortunate, and the source of their joy is external. It comes to them from without. At such a time, simcha just happens, and a family can erupt in shira. Good times, smachot. We call them smachot. Called simchas, smachot. When good things happen, children are born, and grandchildren are born, marriages in the family. All these are times for joy. All these are times for song. Each one is like a kriyat yam suf for us. But that is not the unusual case. That is not the usual case. Usually a happy family is one that creates its own happiness. It sings and thereby evokes the happiness that it seeks. That's a Shabbat song. When the family sits around the table and we sing songs to Hashem of praises, and we feel togetherness and we feel celebration and we bring out the joy in our hearts of living a Jewish life. That is the happiness we have to try and find. And that is the seventh day of Pesach. That's what it symbolizes. Finding happiness in marriage. Finding happiness in marriage to God as well. Finding happiness in our lives. This is not only a question of marriage, but of each individual as well. So a lot of people today are very unhappy. But we have to tell them, no one can make you happy. Happiness is your freedom of choice. It's a free choice decision that only you can make. I told my children, I cannot make you happy. I can try and provide for you enough comfort, but you have to make that decision to be happy. And it's very, very critical that we all realize that. No one can make us happy. We decide. It's a free will decision. That's why we don't pray every day for happiness. Hashem says, I can give you wealth, I give you health, I give you other things, but I cannot give you joy. That joy is your decision. You have to make that joy. And that's what they did on the seventh day of Pesach. They made this decision to praise Hashem with a song. Be happy. Thank you, Hashem, for all the miracles you made for us. We are happy. We're going to sing a song of joy. So it's very interesting. This seventh day of Pesach is the song of joy. If we are human beings, if we possess a modicum of dignity, we can take our lives into our own hands and to a large extent determine whether we shall be happy or we shall be miserable. The rabbis noticed this is very, very beautiful, beautiful idea. Pay attention, beautiful idea. Most of the Psalms of King David begin with this superscription. Mizmor le David, Psalm 23, Mizmor le David, Hashem ro'e lo yitzar, and so on and so forth. A Psalm of David. That's how most of the Psalms start, a Psalm of David. This is the case, at least one case where it says le David Mizmor. For David is a Psalm. They interpreted this to mean that usually the happiness must come from without. The inspiration to sing must come from without. Mizmor le David, a song of David. That the impetus to sing came from without David, came from outside King David. Something he saw, beautiful flowers, or beautiful trees, a beautiful event, and Mizmor le David. But sometimes it came from within. And that's le David Mizmor. Inspiration occurred to David And he had that reaction. I've got to make myself happy. It's not coming from without me. It's coming from inside me. It's inspiration to sing. The David Mizmor. David must, by an act of will, by a sense of high and heroic resolve, create his own inspiration and begin to sing this holy song. It can be done. That we can find the inspiration to make ourselves happy, to make ourselves sing. It doesn't always have to come from the outside. It doesn't always have to be Mizmor de David. It can be the David Mizmor. David, King David, made himself happy, sang himself. He caused the song. And this holds true for marriage and family as well as for individuals. A person has a right to expect happiness from marriage, but he has no right to expect that good fortune will be his or hers at every step. While he passively rides on the crest of euphoria, it is his and her task and obligation to get and give happiness, even if it has to be fabricated selectively out of raw material of experiences and circumstances. And the same holds true in our relationship with Hashem, with God. The marriage metaphor teaches us to carry over this teaching of the seventh day of Pesach into Jewish life. Even in times that are difficult and tense, we must be able to sing. Even in our days where Jewish life seems threatened all over the world and the future seems very ominous, we have no right to fall into doubt and gloom and hesitation and despair. It is easy enough to be a proud Jew after June 1967, the Six-Day War. However, today it's much harder. And this is the real test. To sing of your Jewishness even when you sing alone. To be content in your Jewishness even when the world is alienated to you. Really, we're living in very difficult times, and this is the time we have to sing. We have to be Mizmor LeDavid. No, we're going to be LeDavid Mizmor. Outside events are not making us happy. We have to find the happiness ourselves. We have to find something to motivate us to praise Hashem. So beautiful ideas, the significance of Pesach. I want to talk about something else, which is the centerpiece of Pesach, matzah. What is matzah all about? And there's two phrases in the Zohar for matzah. It calls matzah the bread of faith. And we know that is the bread of our fathers. So the Torah refers to matzah as the bread of our fathers. Per Torah, da'avuho, which is probably borrowed from the Haggadah. Ha'lachmaniya, di'achalu avatana. This is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate. So the Torah calls it the bread of our forefathers, which our ancestors ate in Egypt. And the second term is michla le'me'emnuta, the food of faith. Matzah is the food of tradition. Our forefathers ate it. And matzah is the food of faith. There's two kinds, two symbolisms, at least of matzah. There's many symbolisms. Let's just take these two symbolisms and remember them. One is the food of our fathers, and one is the food of faith. And these two things symbolize two major approaches of a Jew, that of tradition and that of faith. Tradition and faith. And both of these are implied in the verse of the song that Moses and Israel sang on the shores of the Red Sea. Ze keli ve'anvehu, this is my God, and I will glorify him. Elokei avi varom menhu, the God of my fathers, and I will exalt him. So this is my God, and it's the God of my fathers. The God of tradition of my fathers, and the God, my faith in God. Two ways to come to God. One is through tradition, and one is through emunah. One is through one's own faith. And the matzah is called the matzah of our fathers, tradition, and the other one is called matzah of faith. There's two aspects to our relationship with God, the tradition and faith. Now, what is stronger, tradition or faith? So it's interesting with the emancipation in the 18th and especially 19th centuries, many Jews sustained a massive loss of their own personal religious commitment was crushed. Nonetheless, many of those who had lost faith retained a powerful link to tradition and historical continuity. They kept up a strong national and historical continuity. The languages of the Jews, the fellowship of the Jews, the cultural patterns of the Jews were accepted naturally by them. They no longer knew the food of faith, but they still ate the bread of their fathers. What about today? Which matzah will be ours? the matzah of faith and the matzah of tradition. So I am pessimistic when they're talking about tradition. We see all around us, tradition basically is broken. Tradition is broken, except for the minority, like those of us who are present here in this class, who are sensitive to ancestors and history and continuity. Most Jews lack a sense of tradition. They lack an awareness of their fathers and their mothers and their grandfathers and grandmothers. Their own fathers and mothers are probably as assimilated as they are. And the grandparents of most of them also had departed from the wellsprings of our tradition. And therefore, ethnicity alone is not going to make us survive. The matzah of tradition is not the matzah that's going to help us survive today. What then can? And the answer is the matzah of faith. The matzah of faith. In this age of cynicism and materialism and hedonism, the way of faith will triumph. And this is maybe very naive on my part to think about faith as the engine for regeneration of the Jewish people. There are whole ages when the dimensions of the human personality go into the eclipse, only to reappear at a later time. And maybe this is what happened to faith. Faith was in eclipse for a long time. And Bezrat Hashem, in our day, we're seeing more and more that faith is regenerating and reemerging with a strength and clarity heretofore unsuspected. So the confidence is that we'll come after great disappointments with our other faiths, with our other beliefs. The rabbis put it this way. Kol ha-kofer b'avodah zarah, kilu kiyem kol ha-torah kula. A person who denies idols is as if he observed the whole Torah. What does that mean? The denial of the idols of our time lead us to the affirmation of Hashem. Faith is achieved in one of two ways. Either one is born into it, or one understands it in a certain flash of intellectual insight, or one is blessed with a revelation from heaven. This was the way of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses. The other way is one of tortuous climbing, of searching with all its bitter disappointments and setbacks, of worshipping every idol until one learns how false they are. And then in the ashes of one's frustrations, one discovers the secret of faith. This was the way of Abraham Avinu, our forefather. This was the way of Yitro, who became a Jew. They worshipped all the idols in the world till they denied them all. And then they found faith in the true one God. When the people of Israel will return to their sacred sources, will be the way of Abraham and Yitro right today. Many of us will come to God only when our idols will be shattered, the shards of their clay feet puncturing our illusions and goading us to look upwards beyond the confines of our creations. And for indeed, our idols have already are in the process of falling and falling. What, after all, are the idols of our time? The most significant of them may be said to be the following: science, power, especially political power, money, the self, the ego, pleasure, the philosophy of hedonism. Each or all of them together is used in a limited way, can certainly be valid from a spiritual point of view. But the problem is that we have turned to them as ends rather than means. And we have put one or all of them, our ultimate trust and our absolute faith, and they are failing and failing fast. It's a truism that science produces good results and bad results. It heals us and makes life more comfortable, but it destroys the environment, puts dangerous bombs in our hands. There is nothing unusual about that piece of information. It's only that we begin to realize that science is a tool that can be used either way, for good or for bad. And it's not something we worship. Money and the material are certainly the objects of faith. In the communist world, materialism reigns supreme. In the non-communist world, especially America, we've all gone along unconsciously, elevated free enterprise, the capitalist system, Wall Street, the good things of life, to religious values. But who today could venture such a reckless religion? Who today is not afraid of the very systems we so idolized? Ego also can become an idol. Self-expression, self-realization can be important psychological tools. Certainly, we must seek to enhance the self and not crush it. By all means, self-expression is important, and it must teach us not to impose unthinkable discipline upon young minds and simply throw in data and information to passive brains. But today we have gone to the other extremes. We've begun to worship the self, and therefore we've learned how to destroy the self. We have made a bitter discovery. What self? A self without values, a self without meaning, a self without worth, a self without transcendence, without spirituality. Psychology, when transformed from a way of understanding and healing, which marked as a genuinely significant tool for man's happiness, becomes a religion and a focus of absoluteness, makes it idolatry and disappoints its worshippers. Pleasure is in the same category. Our permissiveness was supposed to give us a sense of primitive joy. Instead, it has left us with a residue of profound elemental sadness. Instead of a life without hang-ups, we have a life full of a variety of hangovers. With every inhibition we have destroyed, whether for psychological or philosophical reasons, we have increased our sense of impotence and apathy. Political power used to be something we trusted in, no more. Today, the most industrial of nations stands with a begging bowl at the feet of oil. Sheikhs who have benefited from the accidents of geology and geography, who can rely on power? So we have seen this idea that all these political systems, eventually they're bound by the natural resources. They have to go back to natural resources. And we're in that boat today. Who can we trust? Who can Israel trust? Are the politicians trustworthy that David HaMelech signed it up in the Book of Psalms? Al tiftechu bil divim, don't trust in the great ones. Beben adam she'en lo tishua, people who can't even save themselves, how can they save us? So it's very fascinating. These are our idols that we have to smash. And eventually they're being smashed one by one. So when the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, we are told, Vayar Yisrael and Yisrael met at Sfatayam. The Jews saw that Egypt was dead by the side of the sea. And Israel saw Egypt dead on the shores of the sea, and they believed in the God and in his servant Moses. When we saw the dead Egyptians, now we believed in God and Moshe. It doesn't say we saw the Egyptians or the people of Egypt dead at the shores of the sea. They saw Egypt dead at the sea. Not the people of Egypt, they saw Egypt dead at the sea. How does one see a whole nation dead? What Torah means is that Israel saw not only the massive of individual Egyptians who were destroyed, but they saw Egypt and all that it symbolized. The naked worship of brute power, tyranny of riding high, that was dead at the shores of the sea. And when such an idol is smashed, only then one comes to an act of high faith in Hashem and in his servant. This is amazing. When we smash all those idols that we really believed in. We believed in whatever the army and the air force and the navy and everything we see is today. Can't rely on it. When our idols are smashed, there's only one we can trust in, and that is Hashem. Hashem is the only power we can trust in. There's no political powers we can trust in. Our friends become our enemies, our friends, whatever they are. Bezrat Hashem, Hashem will turn their hearts and give them help us to win this war, win this battle. So this is interesting, this idea that there's two ways to come to God. One is through the God of tradition, and the other one is the God of Emunah, the God of faith. Bezrat Hashem, all of us, this Pesach, will come to the God of faith through the matzah of faith. So the matzah is called the matzah of faith, and the matzah of our fathers. We should come to God through the matzah of faith. But there's another name for matzah. The other name for matzah is called lechem oni, the bread of affliction. Or lechem oni can also mean the bread of answering all the questions of Pesach. So it's the bread of affliction, the poor man's bread, a denial of the ability of money or material influence to save us. It's the poor man's bread. It's a refutation of the omnipotence of science and technology by the very fact that matzah must be made from the simplest of substance, flour and water alone, in the most primitive of ways. The matzah is a bread which does not rise, it does not puff itself up in boastfulness, is a symbol of humility, a denial of the value of the ego in and of itself. Pleasure, too, is counted out by custom. We do not put salt in the matzah. You can dip the matzah in salt, which is what we do. We're not allowed to put salt in the matzah itself. Why? It's an idea that it does not symbolize pleasure. Matzah does not symbolize pleasure. It symbolizes affliction. Even when power is denied, symbolized by the fact that the matzah we eat at the Seder, in fulfillment of the special commandment, must be prusa. It must be broken. The middle matzah is broken, and we don't have two complete matzahs. Well, actually, we do. Today, we have three matzahs. The middle matzah is broken. We hold the two matzahs, make hamotzi, just for lechem mishneh. But then we drop the bottom matzah and make the bracha on the matzah on 1.5 pieces to symbolize poverty and simplicity. So it's called lechem oni, the bread of affliction. For the majority of our people, it will not be a journey from traditional nationalism to faith. It'll be from faith to tradition or nationalism. So we have today try and build faith. We have to try and build our faith up. And ego can become an idol. And we have to break all these idols. It's a very important idea. And go to the food of faith. And Judaism will then become highly attractive. Kol dichfin yeteh v'yechol. Whoever's hungry should come and partake. All the hungry people. All the people who are hungry for spirituality should come and partake in our religion. All who are in need of some linkage to God will come and join us. Kol dichfin yeteh v'yisach. Whoever is hungry, come and partake of Pesach. Belief in Hashem. All who feel a thirst for their people and their brethren will join us. I should like to make it clear that by faith, I do not mean some kind of primitive, simple-minded faith, but a sophisticated, intellectual, and alert faith. Remember, the mitzvah can only be made from the five species of grain, the very substances which alone, if leavened, can become chametz. The matzah and the chametz have the same letters with one difference. Matzah is mem tzadi hei, and chametz is chet mem tzadi. The difference between a hei and a chet is just the closure of the top left corner. The hei is open in the left corner, top left corner, and the chet closes it. A tiny difference between matzah and chametz. They're both made from the same ingredients exactly, the very same items, which can lead to idolatry, must be used in creating the bread of faith. It's a very important idea that the way to faith can be through the path of breaking through the idolatries. When a person realizes nothing can help them, I've tried everything in life, nothing can help me. That's when we come to Hashem. That's one of the ways to come to Hashem. When the money will not help us, when the weapons will not help us, when everything will not help us. And then we'll come to Echad Miyodea. Who knows one? Echad Ani Yodea, Echad Elokeinu. I know one, one is our God. And even we affirm our complete faith in our God, he will say to us, as the shepherd sang of the beloved in the Song of Songs, Ata achat hi yirati tamati, rahu bano bisharuha, my dove, my undefiled people of Israel is but one. The daughters of the other nations saw her and called her happy. The queens and concubines, the great powers too, they praised her. Be'ezrat Hashem, we will see this in our day. The Geulah Shlema, we will come to God through faith, and everyone who cares and pays attention will join us. And kol dichfin yeteh v'yechol, whoever is hungry will come and partake. Kol dichtzrich yeteh v'yisach, whoever needy to come and take part in the Pesach, in this meal of emunah, of joy, Bezrat Hashem, and salvation.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.